And this week's scientist, after dinner scientist, is our toxicologist, Leo Shep, back on the line from, I'm guessing, Dunedin, in your bubble, Leo. Yep. How are you doing?
I'm in my bubble in Dunedin, or in Mosgiel. Yep, I'm fine.
You made it back COVID. Because, you know, was it the last time we spoke, Leo? Was just at the start of all this, and you were, in fact, weren't you? Well, that's right, we spoke to you when you were in the United States, just about to come back home. You got back home in some, I think we spoke to you after you got back home briefly.
And I sent you an email.
Yes, that's right.
Safely.
You made it. You made it. And you never came down with any symptoms?
I didn't. I went through San Francisco Airport and I had to cross security to get my tickets from New Zealand because United wouldn't do it in San Diego. And I had to cross again. It was cheek and jowl with people for about 3/4 an hour. So if I was going to get it, it would have been then. But I didn't.
So you didn't? Now carry on, Leo.
To my knowledge. To my knowledge, I didn't get it. Maybe I was asymptomatic. I don't know. But once I got back to New Zealand, I went straight into quarantine.
And no need for you to take hypochlorite.
I wouldn't recommend it at all.
Here's a little bit of background for those who haven't followed this. This is one of the things that, I mean, President Trump seems to almost be moving into a state where he does soliloquies, almost kind of as if there's nobody there, I sometimes wonder, in terms of the media. He just comes out and things float. They float out of his mind via his mouth. And one of the things that floated out was that maybe if you used hypochlorite, I don't know how you'd get into the body, but maybe that would knock out the COVID-19 coronavirus. Now, tell us about the... we won't bother with the health benefits of this because he's said it all. Let's talk about the health risks of this.
Okay.
First off, what is hypochlorite?
Hypochlorite is a very simple molecule. It's just a sodium and a chlorine and a hydroxy group, or an oxygen, you should say. It's a HClO. And it's in household bleach, usually 3-5% strength, and you can buy it from your local supermarket.
Is it the active ingredient in bleach?
That's the active ingredient in bleach. It's also at a high pH because if you drop the pH down too low, you'll form chlorine gas, and that's always an issue. So it's kept a relatively high pH, and then it has its activity by whatever biological surface it comes into contact with. And yes, it will kill. COVID-19, no problem at all, but everything else in its pathway as well.
Bacteria, human cells, anything.
Exactly, anything. Or anything mammalian, or any tissue, I should say, not mammalian, but any tissue it comes into contact with, it'll oxidize it. Bingo. There are two forms of hypochlorite. There's the sodium hypochlorite, which is in your household bleaches, and there's also calcium hypochlorite, which is in your swimming pool disinfectants. And calcium's got a 2+ charge, it's a divalent cation, and so for it will have 2 hypochlorides ionically associated with it, so it's almost double the strength, if you like, per mole compared with sodium, and also the strength is higher as well. So
is,
2 forms available.
Is that the stuff that gives swimming pools their chlorine smell?
Well, the chlorine smell, yes, I mean, it's a powder, and you add the powder to your swimming pool, but quite often that chlorine smell is what's called chloramines, and that's what happens when the bacteria interact with any biological matter in the swimming pool or wherever, and there can be quite a bit of material in the pool, and it'll react and will form the what they call chloramines. So, for example, if you've in a house and you, say, go out of town for a week or 2 weeks and you live in a cul-de-sac, and you come back and you turn the tap on, you may smell a chlorine smell. That happened to us when we were first married. In the first house we lived in, it happened. And that chlorine smell is not chlorine gas, it's actually chloramines, which have reacted to algae that's been sitting around in the pipes that haven't been moving with water because you've been away on holiday.
Are you saying that a swimming pool which has got a chlorine smell means that there's maybe been a bit of bacteria action in it that is... possibly brought by humans, other humans to the swimming pool, maybe even yourself.
Yes, we can let our minds, imagination go forward on that one. But yes, it'll be human material in the swimming pool. It'll react with and form chloramine.
Now, getting back to hypochlorite and why it kills cells. Why does it kill bacteria and anything else cellular?
Okay, well, hypochlorite is a very strong oxidizing agent. And oxidation is something that will cause something to be oxidized, which, and oxidation means loss of electrons, and so whatever it associates with and causes that oxidation will lose some electrons, which will be gained by the by hypochlorite. And in that process, it kills whatever it comes into contact with. When hypochlorite is dissolved in water, it actually forms hypochlorous acid and hypochlorite. Okay, and so you've got these two species, and depending on the pH, one will dominate above the other. For example, anything above below 3, then you're going to start forming chlorine gas. Anything between 3 and 7, you'll have predominantly hypochlorous acid. Anything above 7, you'll get the hypochlorite in solution. And so, for example, if you've got some on your tissue, you know, let's say, assume it's about pH of 7.4, which is the pH of blood, then I would expect to be 50-50 between hypochlorous and hypochlorite and sodium hypochlorite. Well, not sodium, it's now the hypochlorous acid and the hypochlorite. So, and those two, well, particularly the hypochlorite acts as oxidizing potential, and the hypochlorous acid has the acidic properties, and both of them cause damage.
What are the molecules in our cells, in our tissue, that the hypochlorite is more likely to react with, to oxidize?
I'm not sure. I think anything goes, anything it comes into contact with, whether it's a phospholipid membrane, whether it's the membrane proteins there, or whether it gets into the cell and damages, say, the organelles like the mitochondria. They don't, and if you read the literature, you know, I sent you a copy of our review paper that we published last year on the subject. It just anything it comes into contact with, non-specific. I mean, some drugs will have a mechanism of action that interacts with the receptor, like I talked about with the rhododendrons last time. But this one's non-specific; it'll just go for anything, really.
If we were to inject this into our bodies,
yes,
what would happen?
Well, it's very rare people inject themselves with it. It's not pretty. I mean, I listened to that clip again tonight, you know, just to remind myself what he said, and it seriously caused a shiver to go down my spine. It really did. People typically have, if you read the peer review literature, it's only one, usually, you know, 1 mL, less than 1 mL of a bleach they'll inject, and they get a bit of pain, chest pain, and they may get a bit of vomiting and redness around the area, irritation where the site of injection, and that's it. There was one paper where basically they injected the large volume. I won't describe how they did it, but they managed to inject a large volume into their body, and it caused massive hemolysis of the red blood cells, release of the contents of the red blood cells. And then what happened then was, because there was a massive release of hemoglobin and other bits and pieces from the red blood cells, they had an effect on the kidney, and they needed dialysis. They had some hypertension, and they suffered cardiac failure, but I think they did survive. So in that instance, it caused massive release of the membranes of the red blood cells, causing the release of hemoglobin, etc.
Did the person who did this survive?
They survived. They did.
It sounds painful, though.
It would be. They were intensive care. They were definitely intensive care. And the other cases where I don't want to go there too far down the volume, the other track of the volume, because some people might say, I must give that a go. But usually most people do less than 1 mL of bleach, and it's usually pain at the time, vomiting, irritation, and damage to the site of injection, and they come right as a rule. But there are only about 3 or 4 papers reporting this, so we're limited in the information we have based on the case reports that have been published. And we covered those papers in our review paper, which we published last year in Clinical Toxicology. But that's the sort of things you would expect. And when the President of America said, inject it, I can't describe it. It was a horrible sensation when he said that. For me, it was, particularly that I know so much about it, and we Griffiths wrote a review paper on it last year.
Do you know if many people did? Have you checked out what's happened in the United States? Were there then people presenting at hospitals?
Well, they said the poison centers in America, they gather the stats, and they go to a national body, and then those stats are published every year in Clinical Toxicology, and you know what the trends are and what people are taking, you know, how many children are being exposed to this, that, and the other thing, how many overdoses, how many deaths, and all that sort of thing. And they said that there was a spike in people ringing the poison center, either inquiring about what happens if you do, to those who actually followed that advice, there was a spike in calls to the poison centre across North America.
What about if you try to drink it? I remember as a child, that was one of the things you stayed away from, anything bleachy. That was the stuff on the top shelf.
Yeah, that's right. Well, very low concentrations, it does act as a disinfectant for water. You know, for example, let's say, during the Christchurch earthquake, it's a good example, when the water supply was compromised and where sewage was getting in and stormwater fluid were getting into the water system and the coliform counts were going up and things like that, then the advice is to give very low concentration, parts per million of hypochlorite. It's great, a very low concentration. And remember, toxicity depends on the dose. You know, if I have a bit of salt, sprinkled on fish and chips is very nice. If I deny myself salt, then I might have hyponatremia. But if I take too much salt, I'll have hypernatremia, which will cause toxicity. So a small amount in the water is fine, okay, because it'll disinfect the water and you can relatively safely drink the water. And there are enough references on the internet where you can work out the strengths you need. But if you start drinking the stuff, then it's going to start oxidizing the gastrointestinal tract. That's what it'll do. Initially, the concentrations are low, and the volumes that are ingested are usually the children who swallow it. And usually they come right. And so you keep an eye for nausea, vomiting, burning sensation in the throat. Sometimes there may be a little bit of blood in the vomit and abdominal pain, and usually they come right. It's when people swallow large volumes, they start coming unstuck. And then you start seeing some serious injury. You know, as I said, hypochlorite, anything it comes into contact with, it will oxidize. And that's why it's so good in services, household services, you know, where you see pictures of people spraying, you know, carriages in places like Tokyo or Korea. And probably they were using hypochlorite solutions because anything it comes into contact with the service will oxidize it. And so as you swallow it, it's going to oxidize the mucous membrane. And again, because the volumes are small, it's going to be more of an irritant. But as the volumes go up, or the concentration goes up, or both the above, you're starting to see an injury occurring in there. And you might get redness and swelling of the gastrointestinal tract up behind your tongue. You may get swelling, we call it dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, laryngeal edema, where you get hoarseness of your voice. And in worst-case scenarios, and it's very rare, you can see this more with acids and alkalis, but you can get ulcerations in the mouth and the esophagus can occur, but it's very rare and has to be large volumes.
Again, it sounds extremely unpleasant.
Oh, it's very unpleasant.
And was there any spike in calls to the poison centre in New Zealand after the stump came out from Trumpton?
I'm retired.
You don't know. Well, hopefully not.
You have to ring the poison centre after. Yeah. I can't answer that. I don't.
Yeah. But if we were to use it just to clean surfaces, it's a good substance, a useful substance.
Absolutely. Even if you inhale a little bit, it's just going to go, oh, that smells a bit strong. And that's about it, really. I mean, used as per the instructions on the bottle, it's fine. Okay, not a problem. Spray the surfaces, inhale some of the mist, a little bit of the mist. Shouldn't be a problem. Not a problem at all. And people can use it with confidence for what it's designed for, but not to be used to try and destroy COVID-19.
At least not once COVID-19 has got into your body.
Exactly, yes. After I said it, I realised I should have qualified that by saying, yes, on a surface, absolutely. Great approach. But upon ingestion, no. Talk to your doctor about it and see your doctor if you've got symptoms, etc., etc.
Now, Leo, for some light relief, you've suggested a topic which I've been thinking about a little bit recently in a roundabout kind of way, because we've had quite a lot of wasps coming to visit our house recently, and the wasps obviously are attracted to something. Don't quite know what it is. Mm-hmm. But still, there's a few wasps around, and they come inside, and they're on the windowsill, and then they die. A lot of insects do that. I don't know if this happens where you are, but they come, and they're on the inside of the windowsill, and they get dehydrated, and then they're dead. And then you pick them up carefully, because I've always been told the wasp can still sting you even when it's dead. So pick it up from its tail, pick it up from the head or the side, and carefully chuck it out the window. But I've been thinking, I think the wasps that are visiting our place are German, but I could be wrong. But does it, the sting is quite different on the two main kind of wasps that we see in New Zealand?
That's the German wasp, and the common wasp of the Germans called Vispula germanica, and the common wasp is Vispula vulgaris, if I can get my Latin correct. I thought about it because somebody had sent an email to Radio New Zealand to ask about that after they'd been stung by both species. I can't find a difference between the two of them. I looked into it. I even tried to work out what the LD50s were. I found some for other species of wasp that were in New Zealand. They did actually do some LD50 studies, but nobody seems to have done it. Or if they have, I couldn't find it.
Can I ask you what LD50 means?
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course, it's lethal. It's very politically incorrect now. It means basically how toxic is this product? We'll give it to a subpopulation of rats and would increase. Well, they increase the dose until 50% of the population of those animals die. That's called an LD50, a lethal dose.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it's crude, but it's effective. And all your pesticides, for example, WHO classifications are based on LD50s, for example. All your organophosphates, your organochlorines, Roundup, everything. It's all based on the lethal dose 50%. So it's commonly used. And I thought, well, I'd get a handle on it. All snake venoms have their respective LD50s, for example. So I tried to find it, and I couldn't find anything. And I looked into it further, and I thought, okay, what's in the venom? And it was quite a complicated soup. I was quite surprised the amount of chemicals that were in a venom that when he jabs you or envenomates you. And they tend to divide into three groups. You've got your low molecular ones, which I would call the biogenic amines, like histamine, dopamine, tyramine, and ghrelin. And they're associated with pain and increasing permeability of capillaries, which leads to localized inflammatory response. Not a big deal. It's painful at the time, and it goes away, and it remains localized. Then you get the large molecular weight ones, which are enzymes as such, which then can phosphorylases and the like, and they will then actually cause injury and death to mitochondria, for example, themselves. But again, it's localized. You know, one envenomation by wasp or a couple of envenomations by wasp, not a problem. It's only when you get stung by a multitude of wasps, then it becomes systemic, okay? But also, the biggest concern is actually allergic reactions, and as far as I understand, and I'm sure somebody will correct me, the allergic reaction is just as it can occur with either species, with the Germanica and the Vulgaris.
Is there much difference? Sorry, Leo, to interrupt, but is there much difference between bee stings and wasp stings in terms of the toxin?
Again, I know, if I knew you were going to ask that question, I'd go away and read up. every time we've got a question which I can't answer. I don't know, to be the answer to that is. All I know is that the wasp's venom is similar between the two species. Is one more potent than the other? I don't know. I couldn't find information to say it was. But both have those can cause effects, and both carry the risk of an allergic reaction with some people, which can be systemic and it become a type 1 anaphylactic reaction, which is life-threatening.
And I remember you telling me when we spoke about anaphylactic reactions many years ago, that this doesn't happen the first time you take the substance. The body goes, all right, this is dangerous. It's the second time you take it that the body's ready to pounce, and pounces so hard it kills itself.
Well, it causes an allergic reaction. That's right. That's right. So there are some people out there. I mean, I know people. I think one of my brother-in-laws was stung by bees for years. One day he was stung by a bee and he lost consciousness. You know, and before that, he was fine. Weird. So, yes, some people are susceptible, and that was something when I was at the Poison Center, we were always warned people about. No swelling, no redness, no rash. No, good, good. That's good. If there is, call an ambulance. Sort of. That's basically what we said.
There's one thing, though, Leo, and that is, what if you're bitten by a wasp, stung by a wasp, not bitten, of course, stung by a wasp inside, say on your tongue or on the side of your mouth or something like that?
Oh, yeah. That's dangerous. That's one of the things that we'd be concerned about as well. Absolutely. If you're stung on your tongue or inside your mouth, then you could get localized swelling, and that could cause difficulty swallowing, difficulty breathing. And that can be an issue, and we advise anything around the mouth, the lips, the tongue, inside the mouth, seek medical attention straight away. If you've got massive envenomations.
I'll tell you a story, Leo. I was a kiwi fruit picker one autumn, and it was lunchtime.
In the Bay of Plenty?
In the Bay of Plenty, And was there a few wasps around, and a wasp landed on my sandwich just as I was taking a bite. Perfect timing. Went my mouth, and I started to chew, and I thought, that's a rather sharp taste. Spat it out, and there's this chewed up wasp. And I thought, I've been stung. Well, I thought I felt like I was stung, unless it was... but I wait, and I thought, I wonder if this is going to swell up. It was the side of my mouth, I thought, the gob, not my tongue.
Yeah, the gob,
and,
okay.
And, you know, the bit. And I waited for... No, it was fine. I thought, yeah, what were the odds of that? Everyone else around saw it happening. They thought it was very amusing. And I said, what are the odds of that happening? And I said, well, at least I chewed the little bugger up.
Yes, I know. Maybe you chomped it before it had a chance to sting you.
Yeah, but I did feel something. And, you know, unless they've got teeth that bite as well, then what else was making that sharp sensation that felt a bit... I mean, it was sharp enough for me to spit it out pretty quickly.
I'm not surprised. I have known somebody... In fact, I know two people who have been bitten in the mouth, and none of them came to anything untoward. In both cases, if I remember correctly, but it was a long time ago now. But there is a risk there, and you got away with it.
Yes, I did. I'm still here. Dopamine. Didn't you say dopamine is one of the chemicals in the sting?
Dopamine is one of the chemicals, yeah.
Is it possible that people could get stung by a wasp and that might cheer them up?
No, because it's localized.
Right. Okay. So don't inject yourself with bleach to get rid of COVID-19, and don't try to get stung by a wasp to deal with your depression.
Well, the mouths are so small, it's not going to alleviate your depressive symptoms, and it's localized.
Leo, thank you so much for joining us again, and thanks for answering almost all of the questions I threw at you.
Yes, that's right.
And thanks for being there. Because I'm so glad you made it through your quarantine.
Yeah, we got back, okay. We got back. Squeezed in, but we got back.
See you later, Leo. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Okay, cheers.
Good night. That's Leo Shipp, former director of the New Zealand National Poison Centre. He still does a bit of work for them. He's still a toxicologist, back with more toxic talk in about 2.5 months. My, how the world's changed between chats with Leo. What will the world be like? And let's see, it will be June, probably August, early August, by the time we speak to him again.